Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning, August 8th. Hope you're having a good weekend so far, and hopefully the sun will stay out and give us a reprieve from the rain we had Friday and all the terrible weather that made a mess of things throughout this past week. But anyway, I'm just back from the Greenbrier in West Virginia, an excellent golf destination. Had a chance to play the classic C.B. McDonald course, Old White, and the Seth Rayner gem called the Meadows, and the Greenbrier course, and they have a private course called the Sneed, part of the Sporting Club. So it's a lovely resort, and I'll spend time in another show talking more about the golf and all the sporting activities there to pursue in the mountains of beautiful West Virginia. But this weekend, it's the PGA Championship is taking place, the first major on the men's calendar since last July's Open Championship because of the pandemic. And, you know, with the Masters rescheduled for November and the U.S. Open rescheduled for mid-September. And I would normally be at the PGA Championship, but because of the pandemic, the PGA of America has cut back, only allowing media rights holders to go, which is good. I mean, I'm fine with that, as I will gladly stay on the East Coast here and watch it all on television and cover it from the TV and my computer. But this year, the championship is taking place in San Francisco at a classic municipal course called TPC Harding, which was designed in 1925 by Willie Watson and Sam Whiting, who also designed the Olympic Club, which is close by. I was at the Olympic Club years ago, 2012, to cover the U.S. Open when Webb Simpson won it. A lot of great golf in the San Francisco, obviously, Monterey Peninsula area. And TPC Harding, it's a par 70, 7,251 yards, tight, narrow fairways lined with cypress trees. Rough is deep. The greens are smaller, and it's been a good test so far, the first 2 days at least, for the pros, even though the weather has been pretty mild and cooler. And very little wind. But Haotong Li, a 25-year-old from China, is trying to become the first guy from China to win a major. He shot a 5-under-65 yesterday to move to the top of the leaderboard. He played in the morning and enjoyed the spotlight all day. And the television cameras showed him practicing literally the rest of the afternoon after he got done playing into the evening in San Francisco. So the guy is quite serious, and what a work ethic, and obviously wants to go out there and continue to shoot a low number. Just incredible that he's been out there for as long as he has been. Hopefully he won't get too drained to shoot a good number on Saturday and Sunday. But the tournament is still going on as I tape this on Friday evening. And right behind Haotong Li, who is sitting at the top of the leaderboard at 8-under, is Mike Lorenzo Vera of France, who is just one shot behind with 15, 16, 17, 8, four more holes to play. So he, after shooting a 66 on Thursday, Mike Lorenzo Vera is right now 3-under for the round with a lot more holes to play, which so watch out for the Frenchman. Tommy Fleetwood had a great day. He shot a 64. All right, Sky, stand by. I'll be with you in a moment. My golden retriever being a little impatient. Tommy Fleetwood shot a 64. He's at 6-under. Jason Day shot a 69. He's at 6-under after co-leading in round one. Daniel Berger shot a 67. And Justin Rose is right there as well. He is 2-under with one hole to play, 6-under overall. Tiger Woods, only playing his second tournament in 5 months. He shot a 2-under on Thursday, 268 on Thursday, but on Friday, he just did not look good. He couldn't make putts. His bunker play was poor, and he just looked out of sorts. So Tiger hopefully will turn it around. Brooks Koepka is 5-under overall, so he's right now 3 off the pace. with one hole to play here. He shot a 66 on Thursday, and Brooks Koepka is looking to three-peat, which is just incredible. If that were to happen, you know, this guy knows how to perform in the majors, and it would be great to see Brooks win a third straight PGA championship, which just would be phenomenal. He would be, if that were to happen, Koepka would be the first player to win the same major three straight years since Peter Thomson, the Australian, did it at the British Open in 1954, 1955, and 1956. So what a feat it would be for Brooks Koepka. He had a trainer come out in his round on Friday. You know, he came into this season with a sore knee after injuring it last fall, and the trainer was stretching his left side. So, you know, we'll see how much that knee may be an issue this weekend. So look out for Tommy Fleetwood, who just is playing phenomenal golf. He, I think, is the most talented player out there yet to win a major. He hit 12 of 14 fairways on Friday to shoot that 64. And Jason Day looking to win a second major championship. He won the PGA Championship back in 2015 with rounds of 65 and 69. Jason Day looks very sharp. So does Daniel Berger. Now, Daniel Berger has never won a major. Daniel Berger's best finish in a major was at the U.S. Open in 2018 in the top 10. But Daniel Berger is looking pretty solid and is right in there as well. So anything can happen. This is only two rounds in the books at the PGA Championship. So plenty of golf to go in the first major of the year. And can you believe it, with the pandemic, this first major of the year for the men is going on this late in the year here in August. All right, this morning we will learn about the Golf Heritage Society. Dr. Bernicke is the president of the Golf Heritage Society. He will join me. And the Golf Heritage Society seeks to promote an appreciation for the history and traditions of golf and to foster friendship amongst its enthusiastic members, golfers, writers, historians, collectors of the game's artifacts and memorabilia. It's a very interesting collection of people who appreciate golf history and golf memorabilia. So we'll learn all about the Golf Heritage Society in this show. And then Mike Nichols, the chief business officer of the Symetra Tour, the minor leagues, if you will, for the women's tour, will talk about how the Symetra Tour serves as a road to the LPGA. Sports Interview with Anne Liguori is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Robe Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. Dune, D-U-N-E, jewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses, zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game, peakvision.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. My guest is Dr. Bernicke, president of the Golf Heritage Society, which is a nonprofit celebrating its 50th anniversary. And boy, we're going to learn all about this incredible society and your role in it as president. Welcome to Sports Interview, Dr. Bernicke.
Anne, thanks so much for having me.
So talk a little bit about Golf Heritage Society. What is it, and how are all your members connected to golf?
And I'm going to paraphrase our mission statement, a mission statement that gets a little long and boring. We are people who love the game. We're people who are connected to the history and the traditions of the game. And we are people that have fellowship around the game of golf. And so our mission is to enjoy the game in its modern and its historical context, and really advance the appreciation of the game.
And as your website says, the Golf Heritage Society exists to share information about the game's history, players, courses, championships, and equipment.
That is exactly right. And, you know, in the first 50 years, we did that by gatherings, coming together to talk about different aspects. It might be history, it might be collectibles, it might be play clubs, etc. But as we all know, the challenges of the COVID era have challenged us to do things a little differently and be creative. So we can talk a little bit about that as well, if we have some time.
Sure. So how are you all getting together? Zoom meetings or phone calls?
Well, you know, the society once was the Golf Collectors Society, and it was essentially, truth be told, mostly a bunch of older guys with a lot of golf stuff. And that's good because we still have an awful lot of that. But we also have younger people where we've moved to a more diverse approach, both in terms of the people who participate. Hey, young and old, male and female, every color, shape, and geography. And we also understand that many of our members have a variety of connections to the game of golf. Not everybody was a collector only. Many were collectors and artists or players or writers. And we now understand that our proper Golf Heritage Society, which we changed the name 2 years ago and broadened the mission statement to include the diversity of the interests of the game of golf. So that more clearly defines who we are and who we invite and who we hang with.
Well, it's good to hear that you're focusing on diversity, inclusion, you know, not only men, women, junior golfers, and disabled. There's a huge population of disabled golfers out there, Doctor.
So we have had a track record of working with youth through the First Tee. Many of our members have affiliations with the First Tee. I in Pittsburgh put hickory clubs in the kids' hands, and we interact about the what their experience was, and then it stimulates them to have interest in the history, maybe go online and start to learn about the club or club maker, and it goes from there. So the connection to the young people is there. We are telling that story across the country. Our newer focus is, yes, veterans, and yes, think about older people who used to play golf and get out and enjoy it as a recreation, but now they physically can't. They're shut in, they're in a nursing home, they're taken care of in an extended care facility, what have you. You know, we think that maybe we can go to them. Maybe we can visit, maybe we can bring them stimulation, recreation, to help them stay connected to the game of golf. Wouldn't that be great?
Isn't that great? I need to connect you to EQ Sylvester, who's the chairman of the U.S. Adaptive Golf Alliance. I think you two would have a lot to talk about. He is.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, he's promoting, you know, para golf experiences for the disabled, and they have a big championship coming up in October. During a normal season per se, how often mm-hmm. would your members get together, and what kinds of activities would you be able to connect with them at?
That's a really good question. So our standard mode of operation, you know, we have 10 regions, 9 of them across the U.S., and our 10th region is the rest of the world, mostly the Canadians. But we're also connected in the U.K., as you would expect, but also in Asia, South Africa, and Australia. We have members across the globe. And, you know, it's interesting that you ask about gatherings and meetings. Well, when we gather for a regional event, you know, people will travel across the region or two to come because there are some things they're interested in, maybe some collectibles, maybe the camaraderie of hickory game play, that sort of thing. But with us being limited in travel, now we're starting to connect differently. Many of our meetings are starting to happen on Zoom, and we're figuring out, hey, we can maybe visit somewhere, do some videos, post them, have a live Zoom feed. So we're so excited about some of the young talent we've recruited to the board and their ideas and their technical capabilities that really put together the standard description of the old guys with stuff with the now generally younger people with technology. And we can do many more things with all of that. And it could be really a neat mix as we step right through the COVID and build some things that will be permanent.
Sounds like you're making a lot of progress with only what you've been only at the helm of the Golf Heritage Society for what, 9 months, is it?
That is correct. I'm in a 2-year term, but I have to say this is all team sport. We have our executive director and we have several committees. We sat down about 8 months ago and did a strategic plan and changed some things and said, well, if we connect and do this and do that, we'll be refining our approach to who we are and how we are. We're broadening and becoming that diverse. But then the COVID hit and it challenged us even further. And guess what? We're ready. And we're going to be doing some things that are going to make us a better and more desirable, entertaining, and fun organization for the long haul.
Tell us what they are.
Well, some of the things I just talked about, the connectivity. It's always going to be our desire to get together in person. And unfortunately, with the COVID crisis, we were going to host the annual meeting. It's actually the international meeting because people come from across the pond in different places to attend our meetings. But when we get together, we do several fun things. At an annual meeting, we always have a golf event. We always have a banquet. We always have a trade show. And we do a unique thing that's called room trading. We usually locate one hotel and the participants bring their stuff. And the interaction of people in showing in pre-selling before the trade show creates an amazing environment where people get a chance to interact as friends, old friends, new friends. And it's incredible how much education goes on. I will at a certain time decide to go room trading with nothing to buy or sell, but I'll ask somebody, tell me about your balls collection, your clubs collection, your ceramics collection, and I'll just listen and learn. And to me, that is so much fun and so broadening of my appreciation for the game.
Where do most of these collectors who are, you know, members of your society, where do most of them get these collectible items, be it balls or clubs?
If we're talking about antiquities, there are several places, you know, yard sales, estate sales, antique stores will have things. If you're connected, say, through our society, you have people who have things that they would like to share with newer, younger members because they've enjoyed them for a while. So when people come to a trade show, there's a willingness to educate someone about the collecting area, whether it's balls, clubs, historic collectibles like programs from U.S. Opens or Ryder Cups, et cetera. So there's any number of opportunities for people to understand the different variety and types of collectibles and make some conscious decisions about, do they have a gravitation towards something or do they want to just kind of collect some things and see where it goes as they go?
Are you telling me, Doctor, I should hold on to all those programs of every major championship I've covered in my career because one day they will be valuable, which I have held on to, by the way. I talk about collecting. I don't throw any of this stuff out.
And what you just described is an experience And at the time, you decided, I'm going to hold on to this because it was something important to you at the time. Then you put those things together. Now you have the Anne Liguori collection, which chronicles and journals your career. So I don't know. We talk about with the youngsters what's important to you that defines what is collectible. So, you know, our young people aren't going to spend big money on a feathery ball that costs, you know, $2,000 to $5,000, but they sure are going to treasure that scorecard that they played golf with their parents for the first time on a real golf course, or that pencil that they kept from the first U.S. Open golf course venue that they visited, etc. So when we ask our young people about their collections, it's amazing the stories that they will tell us that are personal and that define the value of that object.
Yeah.
Okay. Then there's all the high-end collectibles. If you want to talk about that, that's a whole nother category.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that. What are the high-end collectibles?
Well, what? There's a book that, pardon me?
Go ahead.
There's a book that came out recently. Happens that it was co-authored by our executive director, Pete Giorgetti, and Dick McDonough. And both have been in the area of appreciating golf through collecting for a long, long time. Pete is an expert in some of his, in his youth, training happened in Scotland. He developed an interest and became expert on golf clubs, who made them, where, and has written several books. Dick has always gravitated to golf art and illustration, and has always had admiration for people who not only accumulated collectibles, but were able to highlight them, show them in a magnificent display. So the book is about 20 or 30, I don't know exactly, of those type of collections. And, you know, people like me who have a few of this and a few of that might say, hey, I don't have the multi-million dollar collection, but I do have one of those Crancleeks that's a prize item of a collection of note. So the collectibles have economic value. They have historic value. They have personal treasure value. So when we talk about collecting, I personally advance the idea of talking about all three of those categories.
So there are experts who are members of the society who could advise somebody who has programs from major championships or media guides from major championships, say, in the last 40 or 30 years. There are people in your society who could certainly advise, you know, somebody like me on the value of these kinds of things?
So the short answer is yes. The medium answer is go back 70 years or 100 years. So the most important asset of the Golf Heritage Society is the knowledge base of our membership. And that is to say that we really like to be seen as a go-to source for knowledge on the people, places, and artifacts of the game of golf. So many of our folks have honed down to collect one thing or become experts on an area within the game of golf and golf collecting. And those folks, although they may not be academicians, they have a deep knowledge base of acquired information and experience, and they can speak to the value of items, the history of items. And I like to say that our members can take an artifact and bring it to life by talking about the who, how, when, where, and why it has significance. So when a person joins us, they go to our website, golfheritage, all smalls, no spaces, .org, and they start to see the breadth and depth of the variety of the topics within the game of golf. They understand that there's a lot of people who collect and have potential for educating, advising their membership about what you just asked me, for example. And that is a connection, that connectivity has a value. So when people become members, they have opportunities for entertainment, education, connectivity. So it's really a strong package that we're able to offer to our potential and our members.
Sounds like a very interesting membership. What, just getting last question about collecting in golf, what's the most popular collectible in golf, would you say?
You know, Ian, that is the hardest question. If I put 10 people in a room and ask them, they would give us 10 answers, maybe 5 answers, because some of them would agree, and 10 more people would tell us 10 different answers. It's fun when you do that. I think people like old things that might have connection to the old country and connect us from the old country to the U.S. in our golf journey. There are people who, like you mentioned, collect some things that are relevant to their personal journey, their careers, their experiences of golf travel, their golf participation at tournament venues, for example. So these are things that are commonly found in people's collections. You have some folks that decide to collect balls or develop a focus. So we see it all kind of ways. What is the most popular and the most common? Think of what's the most inexpensive, the pencils, the balls with logos, those kind of things. I think you'll find that almost everybody has a few of those things. You know, Ann, if you have one, it's interesting. If you have two, you have two things that are interesting. When you have three, Ann, you have a small collection going.
You have to come to my basement in the house to see my collection, because I have more than three of everything. I have dozens and dozens of balls, towels, hats,
well, you invite
shirts,
me and I'm coming.
Posters, programs. You know, I basically have run out of space, wall space for sure. But well, we are talking to Dr. Bern Bernacki, who's the president of the Golf Heritage Society and who's also co-chairman of the First Tee of Pittsburgh. How much do the organizations kind of intertwine?
Another good question. Well, we describe the Golf Heritage Society as wanting to advance the knowledge, understanding, and appreciation of the game. And, you know, the First Tee is an educational program that teaches young people life lessons, healthy habits through the game of golf. And our organizations overlap and work together when we sweeten the deal for the young folks. Yes, they become better golfers. Yes, they understand the 9 core values, courtesy, respect, judgment, etc. But when we put a Hickory golf club in their hand and send them out to play 3, 5, 7, 18 holes, and they connect with that club and the game, the old game, they have any number of interesting observations and questions, and it stimulates their connection to the game of golf. So we've done it across the country, and it's generally the same positive experience for the youngster players and the coaches and the parents to say, wow, that was really special.
Well, I wish you all the luck in the world with the organization. It's a very diverse membership, as we've been talking about. And I know there's a discount now for the remainder of 2020, correct?
Correct. So what we did, Ann, is in our 50th year, we reduced our dues to $50. So for the second half of the year and through the end of the year, we have reduced the membership for the rest of the year to $25. This, my friend, is the best value in the game of golf. I invite you and everybody in your audience to please visit us at golfheritage.org. Find us and join us, and let's have fun together.
Well, I appreciate you talking about the society and its membership and how you're really making strides in diversifying the membership. And boy, hopefully in 2021, everybody can get together and play tournaments together and meet at these trade shows you're talking about and continue the fine work of the Golf Heritage Society. Dr. Byrne Bernacki, thanks so much and continued success.
Thanks so much, Ann. We appreciate the opportunity. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. All right, Doctor, I appreciate it. Sports Interview with Ann LaGore is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. Dune, D-U-N-E, jewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses, zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game, peakvision.com. Welcome back with Ann LaGore. It looks gorgeous outside. Hope you have a tea time. And joining me now, Mike Nichols, the Chief Business Officer for the Symetra Tour, which is the road to the LPGA Tour, the official qualifying tour of the LPGA. Good morning, Mike. Welcome.
Thanks, Ann. It's great to be on with you. I have to say that this may be the pinnacle of my professional career for a kid who grew up in northern New Jersey and Basking Ridge, went to high school at Dumbarton School in Morristown, and then got my professional starting golf at the United States Golf Association in Far Hills to be on the flagship station of the Yankees and Giants, my two favorite teams, is quite a thrill. So thanks for having me on.
Oh, our pleasure. It's great to talk to you. And well, tell us about the Symetra Tour. It's somewhat like the minor leagues in baseball, right? The PGA Tour has the Corn Ferry Tour, and the LPGA Tour has the Symetra Tour.
Correct. The analogy that we often use is that we are the LPGA's Corn Ferry Tour. So we'll play in a normal season, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about abnormal seasons here in a second. But, you know, we'll play anywhere from 20 to 23 times across the United States. So we're domestic tour exclusively. We have players from 40 countries. And then it's pretty simple. At the end of our season, the top 10 players on our money list will graduate straight onto the LPGA Tour. So, you know, for people who follow golf and sort of wonder, you know, how does somebody ever get to be a professional on the LPGA Tour? There's really three ways. They can either be invited or Monday qualify into a golf tournament and win, and then they can become a member immediately. They can go through what people are familiar with as the Q School. So we have our Q School, which has multiple levels. So if you were a golfer, you know, just coming out of college and wanting to go, you could go through the Q School process. And then there's the Symetra Tour, finishing in the top 10 on the Symetra Tour. So those are really the main three ways that somebody can get onto the LPGA Tour. And we feel that, you know, seeing a player play over the course of 20-plus tournaments and getting those tournament reps and getting that experience, we feel we're identifying that next sort of generation of top talent that's going to be successful when they get to the LPGA Tour.
So, Mike, so players don't necessarily have to be on the Symetra Tour to get into the LPGA.
That's true. They could, like I said, there are some instances where players had a sponsor exemption and won the tournament. Some recent ones that come to mind are like Lexi Thompson and Brooke Henderson both won tournaments they were invited to, so they immediately received membership. The Q School is three different tournaments. So there's a one stage that we have in California, then we have a second stage that's in Florida traditionally, and then our final stage of Q Series the last couple years has been held in North Carolina. So for somebody who is coming out of college with no, or anywhere around the world, frankly, is coming to play professional golf, comes from being an amateur, wants to turn professional, they could go through those four stages and get onto the LPGA. Now, if you don't quite make it out of that four stage onto the LPGA, the Symetra Tour takes a group of our players who qualify from the Symetra Tour from that Q Series. So it's a little sort of inside baseball there of the mechanics of how it all works. But again, you know, when you look at the Symetra Tour playing 20 times versus the Q School where they're just sort of four individual tournaments, we feel that playing an entire season on the Symetra Tour helps identify the players that are going to be the best over a sustained LPGA season.
So there probably is a large percentage of players who may never make that leap. onto the LPGA Tour, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you think about it, I often say to people, like, if you actually thought about what it takes to become a professional golfer and be one of the top 144 that tees it up on in any given weekend on a tour from around the world, you'd never even start the process. I mean, I use the analogy of, you know, professional football. If you think about the NFL and how incredible of an athlete you have to be to make it onto an NFL roster, and when you consider that there's, you know, 32 teams, and by the time you go through injuries and, you know, the practice rosters and all that stuff, you probably have about 2,000 guys a year who are NFL players, 2,000, and they're all primarily fed by one country. So you got 2,000 guys who are making up NFL rosters. On any given week on the LPGA Tour, we have 144 ladies teeing up, and they're coming from 40 or more countries from around the world. So how elite you have to be playing on the LPGA Tour week in and week out is just incredible. We've got some of the world's best athletes for sure.
And can they play on the Symetra Tour as long as they want if they don't, you know, qualify for the LPGA?
So a player who is on the Symetra Tour can play for as long as she maintains her status. So from year to year, if she is able to stay in the top 80 on the Symetra Tour money list, she'll be able to stay on the tour for as long as she wants. So there's no time limit. We have players who it's taken half a dozen years or so. There's a player, Mo Martin, who's kind of one of the players that we look to. And she played on our tour for somewhere between 5 and 6 years. And a player who you might think, hey, Mo, maybe it's, you know, time to look for something else to do. But she always made enough money to kind of just keep fueling the dream. And, you know, a couple years after graduating from the Symetra Tour, she won the AIG Women's British Open, one of our majors on the LPGA. So there's no sort of time limit. They're not sort of timed off of the tour, but it takes different times. Not everybody's Lexi Thompson or Brooke Henderson, who's, you know, a world beater at, 17 or 18 years old. So it takes time for folks, but that's one of the things, frankly, we've tried to focus on with the Symetra Tour, is trying to make it a little bit more affordable for players to be able to do it for a longer period of time so that money's not the reason that they eventually quit playing.
So what's a prize money like? I mean, can they make a living if they, you know, finish maybe in the top 10 at these events?
Yes. So a player on our tour, so our purses range anywhere from about $125,000 up to $250,000 this year. So the player who wins makes 15% of that purse. So it can be, you know, somewhere from $18,000 up to about $30,000 for winning a tournament, which is a nice paycheck. But traveling the country is certainly not inexpensive. We tried to build a schedule where the players are able to drive from place to place. A lot of the communities in which we stay, we're grateful that people who live in those communities will open their homes to our players so that they can stay in their homes and not incur the cost of hotels. And in some cases, the families will cook meals with the players and help them on those expenses. But, you know, we do have some top players who've last couple of years, the top players on our tour make in excess of $100,000 a year, which, you know, isn't a ton of money when you got to incur all the expenses of traveling the country. But, you know, at the same time, it's ultimately the goal of playing on this tour. The reason to play on this tour is to ultimately get to the LPGA Tour. So if we can keep those top players playing and have enough money to come back year after year, those are the ones that we're really trying to groom for success on the LPGA.
And so how has the tour schedule been altered during the pandemic?
Well, like every tour, there's been an incredible number of cancellations, and you know, for obvious reasons. You know, we were actually we had played one tournament here in Florida before it all sort of hit, and it was sort of hanging. It was interesting. It was sort of hanging in the balance. Our next tournaments were scheduled to be out in California, and it was sort of hanging in the balance, and it was looking like we were going to play those events in sort of that late March timeframe. And we even spoke to the mayor of one of those communities who was all gung-ho about us coming, even though the governor was starting to sort of put the clamps down a little bit there in California. And then all of a sudden, you know, all of the closings came. And it's, you know, it's hard to work within those restrictions when you have all of the, you know, the players, obviously, and the volunteers and the caddies and all the staff that make it go. It sometimes becomes so limiting to have to work around all of the state and local restrictions. But, You know, I think if, as we look, as you referenced at the top of the show, hopefully the PGA Tour will be opening up here in a couple of weeks, obviously without fans. But, you know, we're hoping that we can get to sort of back a sense of normalcy with some other sports returning, that by the time we come back with the Symetra Tour, it'll just be sort of a blip on the radar. Nobody will sort of notice, because hopefully a lot of the other sporting events will have come back.
So now you're also the lead LPGA liaison to the Ladies European Tour. And I know there's a joint venture now with the LPGA. That's a recent thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when the LET, by probably their own admission, has been struggling the last number of years. And as Commissioner Mike Wan likes to say, you know, whenever he talks to the founders, you know, they say, you know, whatever we can do as the LPGA to help grow women's golf, and it's not just grow women's golf in the United States, it's around the world. So we were able to partner with the Ladies European Tour. It's a 50-50 joint venture between the two entities. And the idea is that we would go ahead and bolster the LET schedule. We actually grew this year's schedule by 9 events from what it was the previous year. So we were scheduled to play over, I believe it was 24 times this year on the Ladies European Tour. So it was really going to be an incredible season that we had put together in partnership with them for the players. And the longer term goal is that, to the way players qualify for the LPGA Tour, there's never been sort of an official pipeline from the Ladies European Tour to the LPGA. We have a lot of great European players that have come from the European Tour, but they've come either through the Symetra Tour or through the qualifying school, or, for example, in Annika Sorenstam's case, winning the U.S. Women's Open all those years ago. So it's quite a thing where that we've been able to partner in a way that makes women's golf stronger around the world, and then hopefully in time create an official pipeline for those players directly to the LPGA, much like we have here on the Symetra Tour.
You know, it's great to see the growth of the Symetra Tour. And, you know, the LPGA has just grown tremendously in terms of sponsorships, prize money for the players, the number of tournaments all over the world. And Commissioner Wan has done an incredible job, right? He's been there for 10 years, I think.
Yep, he's been here for just over 10 years, starting in 2010. So it's been a pleasure working with and for him for the last, you know, as long as he's been with the tour. Just a, you know, great leader, instills great sort of loyalty both inside the building and outside of the building in terms of his ability to speak to sponsors. You know, he always talks about the fact that, you know, prior to joining the LPGA, he was in the sponsor's chair. And so whenever we're talking about growing, whether it's the Symetra Tour or LPGA Tour, he's always, you know, coaching us on, you know, let's think about what the check writers, what is it that the check writer wants to hear? So, you know, we're really focused right now. There's so much attention being built right now around women's empowerment and diversity inclusion, and finding ways to sort of empower, whether it's young girls or women in business. And so the LPGA has sort of become a platform around which businesses can show their sort of living their values of, you know, that here's what we're saying and here's how we're demonstrating it is by supporting women's sports. And the LPGA is the longest running independent women's sports association. We've been around for, this is our 70th year. And, you know, it's obviously we're proud of what we've built, especially in the last 10 years with Mike at the helm.
Mike, can these tours survive this pandemic and get back to where they're, thriving again?
Well, I think so. I think people will be pleasantly surprised when they see what the 2021 LPGA and Symetra Tour schedules look like. You know, it's, you know, the 2020 schedule, it's going to be one of those where, whether it's, you know, LPGA, PGA Tour, Symetra Tour, they're going to be sort of an asterisk in the history books. And, you know, ultimately, you know, what we can play, and what we can't. But, you know, the organizations that come out in next year and in the years beyond stronger than possibly we went into 2020, that's how we anticipate both the Symetra Tour and LPGA Tour coming out. And I think that just sort of speaks to the resiliency and the plan that Mike Wan has put in place, because he said, you know, let's just make sure to get through 2020. and make sure that 2020 isn't a drag on 2021. So I think people will be pleasantly surprised when they see what we have in store for next year on both the LPGA and Symetra tours.
Well, I'm pulling for both tours, Mike. Thank you so much for being on the show. Continued success.
Thanks, Anna. We look forward to teeing it up when you're back down here in Florida.
Would love it. Thank you so much. Mike Nichols, Chief Business Officer for the Symetra Tour. Very informative stuff. My thanks to Dr. Byrne Bernicke, who is the president of the Golf Heritage Society, to Mike Nichols, the Chief Business Officer of the Symetra Tour, and to Kyle Lynch in the studio. Enjoy the PGA Championship, everybody. Have a great weekend. Be safe. Be well. Be nice. And I'll talk to you next Saturday morning right here from 7 to 8 on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.